This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. We have three sponsors for the show tonight, the first being Jam Software, who provide ICT staff with enterprise tools that power widespread use of Apple technologies in education. More about them at jamsoftware.com. Secondly, Shobi, an iPad app for paperless classrooms. Shobi makes it easy to assign, collect and review student work and to provide rich feedback with annotations, voice notes and more. And finally, this episode is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, and online store. For a free trial and 10% off, visit squarespace.com/outofschool and enter the offer code PUPIL at checkout. A better web starts with your website. My name is Fraser Spears, and tonight I'm joined by a special guest on the show, my good friend Srini Swaminathan, all the way from India. He's actually recording from the UK. He's the furthest traveled guest we've ever had on the show. He actually traveled not just to the UK to record the show, but it's a nice side effect of him being in the country. So Srini, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Fraser. So glad to be on your podcast.
Yeah, it's great to have you. You know, I don't think I've ever pursued a podcast guest quite as long as I've pursued you. You're a difficult man to pin down.
But finally, I'm glad to be on the same time zone as you and to be here in your podcast. I'm a big fan.
Yeah, well, you're very kind. That crazy half-hour time zone between here and India is... the calculations took twice as long trying to figure out when we were going to call and talk.
Yeah.
Okay, so Srini, for people who don't know you, can you sort of talk us through your personal and professional background and how you came into education as a whole?
Sure. I've been in education only for the last 4.5 years. And before that, I used to be working in oil field rigs and platforms. That was my professional background. And I mean, how this change happened is something, an interesting story. I was born in a low-income community family in South India, and I grew up in poverty, and just going to school and college on scholarships completely changed my life path. And after finishing my engineering, I worked many years in oil field services, and during my work years, I used to think about children who cannot afford to get a good quality education. And I used to volunteer in schools. I used to also donate money and resources for children to go to school. But over the years, a desire to do something more for education grew in me. And that slowly led me towards thinking about engaging in education sector in India full time. And I really wanted to work with low-income community children, simply because of, you know, taking an example from my own life, how going to school and college completely changed my life. So 5 years ago, I joined this program called Teach for India, which puts young Indians in low-income community schools for 2 years, whereby they are given responsibility for one classroom for 2 years, and you teach full-time in those classrooms. And then you hand over the class to a next Teach for India fellow and move on. What in the last 5 years that the program has seen is nearly 60% of Teach for India alumni have stayed back in the education sector in India to contribute towards bringing that change and transformation in the education sector. So I finished the program and I moved to Chennai, my hometown, and started Teach for India there. A year and a half ago, I handed over Teach for India Chennai chapter to a new team and I moved out. And since then, I've been involved in both volunteer teaching in low-income community schools and also involved in a few other projects involving teacher training for low-income community teachers and a couple of other social development projects as well. So that's where I am right now.
Okay, that's a very interesting story. It's so you, am I right that you were responsible for the whole of Teach for India in Chennai? Is that right?
That's right. So yeah. I moved from Mumbai and started Teach for India chapter in Chennai from scratch, which means building it from scratch. And that was a very interesting experience for me, because I've never started up anything in the social development sector. So for me, it was going from the classroom to the city level, whereby I was signing up schools, recruiting teachers, and then involved in teacher training, recruiting staff members, and then raising funds all by myself, and so on. So that was a very interesting experience for me. So I ran that for a year and a half. And then once the program and the city operations stabilized, I handed it over to a team and I left Teach for India. So right now I'm no longer working with Teach for India, but I do support the program as an alumnus.
Okay, that's great. And how do you I guess my question is, what kind of philosophy did you embed into that startup system? You know, I presume that you had a fair amount of, is Teach for India like a program that they set out and you just have to roll out their program, or do you get to shape it for the local situation?
It's more of the latter, actually. Mm-hmm. So Teach for India does have its own vision and, framework, core values and other things. But when it comes to launching Teach for India in a completely new city, especially South India, and the senior leadership team in Teach for India, didn't know much about South India because mostly, they are based in Mumbai, Pune and Delhi. Mm-hmm. So it's very essential that even though they gave the basic guidance and support in launching a new city, they highly did depend on me and my team for evolving the program with a Chennai soul, mm-hmm. When I came to Chennai, my main focus was that every Teach for India fellow in Chennai should look at their classroom like their own NGO or a non-profit organization, and they are the CEO of their classroom.
Okay.
Because I wanted to build that entrepreneurship mindset in the teachers, that they should always ask this question, what will I do about it, rather than looking at themselves as like employees of a nonprofit organization. Because that way you won't be able to take initiatives and bring about that change. You'll always feel like, I'm one cog mm-hmm. in a bigger wheel. Instead, I wanted them to develop that entrepreneurship mindset where they feel like, okay, this is my own startup. Like every classroom is like a startup.
Mm-hmm.
And if they imbibe that culture, if we have that culture in the organization, then that's when we'll see ownership. And I think a lot of changes and magic happens when people take full ownership and feel like this is my startup,
Mm-hmm.
And I would say we were quite successful in building that mindset in the initial year in Chennai.
Okay. And did you see any specific examples? Can you give any specific examples of what teachers did in Teach for India that they might not have done, or you might not have seen in other schools that were not part of that kind of mindset?
So there are many examples of, Teach for India fellows in Chennai, especially taking a lot of initiatives. But these are very basic things, but still I'm quite proud of what they used to do. For example, mm-hmm. classrooms that don't have any furniture at all. Children used to sit on the floor. So fellows or a fellow who was in that classroom raised funds to buy furniture for all the kids in the classroom. So
mm-hmm.
rather than him or her asking Teach for India to give funds or asking the school principal to take ownership and give them the furniture, this mm-hmm. person got the school leader on board, got the community people on board and his friends, family and other network on board and made sure that the furniture, was delivered in the classroom. And then there were a few fellows in one school who got together and organized, for example, a sports and culture event for children in that cluster. Rather than saying that the children don't have any such opportunities to take part in these events, they themselves completely designed the logo, raised the funds and organized this event and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And there are many such examples across the 15 schools that we partnered with in year one. Some fellows raised funds to buy tablets to introduce tablet-based, game-based learning in the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I can just go on and on. But yeah, we saw many such examples of the teachers taking ownership and looking at the classroom like as if it's their own startup organization.
It's something I'm sure a lot of Western countries would love to have their teachers think that way. But I suppose, you know, in one sense, we're kind of stymied a little bit by the fact that, you know, say I was to go and procure furniture for my classroom, I would have to get it, you know, fire tested, and, you know, there would be all kinds of regulatory, you know, safety tested, you know, make sure that the load is acceptable and all this kind of stuff. And I suppose having a little bit of maybe a little bit less oversight helps people be a little more innovative.
Yeah. I mean, we also have examples of the teachers getting in touch with, like, Chennai is known for its singing and dancing, like classical singing and classical dancing people, you know, artists. And there are examples of teachers getting in touch with such people and asking them to come over to their classroom and introduce children to classical singing and dancing, because low-income community children, most of them do not have any access to the classical arts, fine arts.
Mm-hmm.
And that because of that, they also don't have a taste for classical singing and dancing. And they grow up only listening to movie songs, like Tamil cinema songs and so on. So, yeah, we have such great examples, and not just about resources or furniture, but also in such cases.
I'd like to take a moment to mention our second sponsor of the night, and that's Shobi, an iPad app for paperless classrooms. With Shobi, teachers can quickly and easily assign, collect, and review student work on their iPads, then provide rich feedback to students by adding annotations, text notes, and voice notes directly onto documents. Students can show their learning creatively by submitting to Shobi from thousands of compatible iPad apps or by completing assignments with Shobi's built-in tools. Shobi keeps everyone organized with individual student assignment folders, email, and push notifications. Shobi Basic is completely free, and teachers can try it out with their students in just a few minutes. Get started by downloading Shobi in the App Store or by visiting shobi.com. Shobi is also offering a special deal for school admins listening to this podcast. Buy Shobi Pro for 5 of your teachers, and they'll upgrade an extra 5 teachers to Shobi Pro for free. That's a total of 10 teachers and all their students on Shobi Pro for a full year. Visit shobi.com/out of school for details. So, I'll move on a little bit from that time in your life, Srini. I first became aware of what you were doing with Teach for India when you appeared in a video that Apple showed. I think it was WWDC 2012.
That's right. Yes, that's right. Yeah.
How did that come about?
It's a very interesting story. At that time, I used to be teaching in a place called Dharavi in Mumbai. It's one of the biggest low-income communities, or as they call it, slums, in Asia. And it's been there for, I think, 60, 70 years. Over that time, people have settled there. And that's the school that I was teaching in. And during my 2 years of full-time teaching in a primary school, in a classroom there, I used to constantly think about the children and what are the resources I can bring into the classroom to push their learning. And I used to learn from the community in recycling and you being resourceful about using whatever I could find in the school, in the community to teach the children. And naturally, I also turned to technology because, you know, my engineering background helped there.
Mm-hmm.
So I used to bring projectors, for example, V-Sports console or car DVD players and other things. Whatever I could find with myself or my friends, I used to bring that and use in the classroom. And I also used an iPad in the classroom. I raised funds to buy the iPad and projector for my classroom by running marathons. And I used to use the iPad in the classroom to teach children anatomy and other things. And I used to regularly share what I do in my classroom on social media, both on Twitter and Facebook, because my idea was, one, to document my journey as a teacher, and two, I found that as a teacher, if I share online publicly and kindle people's interest in classroom, in education, I can invest more people in the cause that I'm working for. And that way I can gather more support to bring people to volunteer or get resources for the classroom. Mm-hmm. So I used to share a lot on Twitter and Facebook about what happened in class that day. And one such day when I shared what I was doing in my classroom using iPad and apps, medical anatomy apps made by this developing team called 3D4 Medical. They are based in Ireland, and I used to tweet about it, and somehow they saw my tweet and asked me to send some pictures and the story. Like, they were very curious to know what I was doing in that classroom in Mumbai, because their apps are made for medical college students and not for classroom.
Yeah, those are very advanced apps, aren't they?
Yeah, and yeah. I used a free app that they make. I used to use that app for my running practice. So for my marathon practice, I used to use their app to learn about different muscles and why I'm having pain in certain muscle and so on.
Okay.
And I decided to use the same app in my classroom, and they were just surprised that I was using it in a classroom in Mumbai, whereas their intended audience was someone else. And I sent the story to them, and I think they shared that story with Apple, saying that, oh, you know, here is a nice story of apps making a difference in the life of, people.
Mm-hmm.
And Apple liked that story. They got in touch with me. They said, okay, we would like to come and film your classroom. And I said, yeah, you're welcome. They came and filmed, and they left. And I had no idea that it would be shown in the Worldwide Developer Conference.
Really?
So in 2012, there was no live streaming. You know, you could only see live blogs.
Yeah, of course. That was before we were really doing that, wasn't it?
Yeah. So I was watching the live stream, and I was refreshing the page, and when a picture came up with my students on it. So it was such a pleasant surprise, actually. So I was quite thrilled to see my students appear in that video.
That's great.
So that's the story, you know, just... I shared online, and it caught the attention of the developers who passed my story to Apple.
It's a small social network world, isn't it?
Yeah, really. I never expected that one tweet would lead to all this.
Mm-hmm. And how did things change for you after that? Did you get a sort of sudden spike in interest, or did you get any spike in interest at all?
Oh, 15 minutes of, spotlight and fame, as they call it. And these days of social media, things go viral, and they die down virally also with the same peak. In my case, yes. I mean, my Twitter stream was flooded, and people started sharing that on Facebook and everywhere. But I knew that, okay, you know, after this hype is when you need to look at... okay, what is a real change that can happen? Because I wanted to see what can this do for my students? You know, what can this do for pushing the learning of my students? And how can this help my students from dropping out from school, for example?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of resources will this bring to my students and my classroom? In that sense, nothing much happened for nearly 6-7 months after the WWDC. Nothing happened at all till someone from Apple Worldwide Education team in London, Alan, he contacted me, and he asked me to come and present the story at the Apple Education Summit.
Mm-hmm.
And I presented, and that's where I met you also for the first time.
Yes, yes. You posed me the hardest ever presentation challenge that I've had, because just to let everybody understand the scenario, this was like a breakout session that people would come to, and there was three short presentations, and you were, I think, first, and then I was second. And you got up and you gave this great story and this very inspiring story that you've just told all of us. And then I had to get up afterwards and do my presentation. And, you know, people were crying in the audience and getting out their wallets and stuff. And
You're too kind, Fraser.
Yeah. I had to go, well, I work in this private school in Scotland and we bought some iPads for everybody. you're telling stories about running a marathon just to get one iPad for your school, you know. So yeah. I felt about an inch high after your presentation.
No, but yours was very inspiring in a completely different context for me, you know, to look at how you and now more and more I realize how challenging it is to do 1:1 deployment, you know, because your school has kindly donated some iPads to the program that I work in the classrooms I volunteer teach in now. And the more I use those iPads, I realize how challenging it is to do that kind of multiple iPad setups in a classroom. So I'm able to appreciate your work a lot more now, I think, than the first time I listened to you present. And I think you were quite muted in presenting the challenges and the achievements and success stories. So now I realize how hard you know it is to do that.
Well, you know, when you speak at an Apple event, they never want to tell people about how hard it was.
That's true. That's true. But I still managed to get away with showing those challenges and you know, videos of the community I teach in. But I think it puts together the story in a nice way. You know, people understand the context much better if I show those pictures and videos.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to take a moment to mention our next sponsor, Jam Software. Jam Software provide ICT staff with enterprise tools that power widespread use of Apple technology such as Macs, iPad, iPhone, and Apple TV in education. Now with Casper Focus, they've placed these great technologies directly into the hands of teachers who work with students every day. Casper Focus allows teachers to quickly gain students' attention, conduct secure exams within an app, select specific Apple TVs assigned to their class, and distribute iBooks. Even they can initiate AirPlay right from Casper Focus. Learn what else you can do with Casper Focus at jamsoftware.com. Can we sort of delve into that a little bit more, Srini? I mean, how does the context of being in a low-income community, how does that impact a child's education? Because I'm aware that a lot of people listening will be from, you know, the US, the UK, Northern Europe, places like that, where, you know, we have a kind of well-defined education structure and the system. And I know there are, of course, areas of poverty in those countries as well, but really nothing like what you're kind of talking about. Can you, you know, let people know, how does that impact a child's day? How does it impact their education, the length of their education and the quality of it and so on?
Sure. So seeing on a completely different, viewpoint, there are low-income communities all over the developing world, right? In Africa, in India, in even Malaysia and Cambodia, Thailand. So the context does change based on which community you look at, right? So, for example, the low-income communities in Mumbai look much, much worse than, say, some low-income communities in, say, Bangalore or Hyderabad and so on. So, but the challenges that the children face often are very similar. I come from one such low-income community myself, and just by being born in such a low-income community, the odds are stacked up against that child. You know, for example, the risk of dropout from school after grade 5 is the highest for children born in low-income community. Right now, nearly 48% of children born in India do not go beyond grade 5 school education, which is quite sad because 99% of children born in India enroll in primary school at age 5, but only 48% of them, 48% of them drop out.
Okay.
At grade 5 level, and 90% of the children born in India do not enter any kind of college or university. These are big numbers, you know. So the reason this happens is most low income community children go to free government schools.
Okay.
And the government schools do struggle with good quality teaching and learning simply because of a lot of issues, you know, like, for example, teacher accountability, teacher training, and then resources is actually, I would say, not such a big problem when it comes to government schools in India.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of them do have kind of somewhat good infrastructure, like a proper building and so on. But the challenges are more in terms of teacher accountability, teacher training, and then other poverty-related issues like malnutrition in the children.
Okay.
Sanitation and hygiene issues affecting the children's attendance in school.
Mm-hmm.
And then government school teachers really struggling with the number of children in per classroom.
Mm-hmm.
So often when I was teaching, I would prepare a lesson plan for 40 students. And then it would rain. And when I go to school, I'll find 80 students in my class because, you know, the classroom in the ground floor had been flooded because of the rain. So they had to send the 40 children to my classroom, which was on the first floor. So suddenly I'm faced with 80 students in the classroom who I have to teach for the entire day. So everything goes into the drain. Like all my plans are gone. So to summarize, children in low-income communities, at least in the cities that I've worked in, Mumbai, Chennai, struggle right from day one because of lot of issues that are unique to the community, like sanitation, hygiene issues, malnutrition because good quality food is quite expensive and unaffordable for them, and the only learning time, proper learning time they have is in school, because once they go home, often there is no power, and they have to share a very small space with 7 or 8 family members and others. Often children sit and study on the streets under street light or a shop light and so on. And many boys actually also help their parents in their business after school or before school.
So there's economic pressure there as well.
Yeah, many of my students.
In education.
Yeah, many of my students who were in grade 2 and grade 3. Their parents used to run a leather factory or a tiny leather factory or a garments business and so on. So the children, it's very natural for them to spend the hours before school and the hours after school in their dad's shop or, tailoring unit or other things, helping the dad run the business. So these are some of the challenges, that I noticed as a teacher, spending a lot of time in the community with the students.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How does sort of aspiration play? You referred earlier to students not having a lot of access to fine arts and things like that. Is there a kind of cultural aspect that children from those kind of communities are not expected to spend precious time and energy on education versus perhaps making money for the family or helping at home or whatever?
Yeah, so I think most parents in the communities that I work in look at education as what children acquire in school.
Mm-hmm.
So they say, okay, you'll come back from school now. Okay, if it's a girl, they'll ask her to do household work. Wash the vessels or wash the clothes and do other things. The boys are usually asked to help with the father or other uncle and others in their business and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the only form of entertainment that I've seen my students get is Bollywood movies, Bollywood songs, or some program on the TV.
Okay.
But very rarely anything that's really educational and something that can help or supplement what they learn in school and classroom. So this was one major challenge for me where I wanted to extend the school hours or the learning hours even into their home. So I used to do certain things like, giving them things to work on at home. Not exactly homework, but something exciting to do. Even if it's like something like finding words in a big jumbled printout or coloring certain things so that finally a word would be revealed. Things like that would kindle their interest.
Okay.
But also recording things on their father's phone where they could listen to that. Or giving them things like, I would tell them, before you throw away a biscuit wrapper or a juice carton or anything, you have to write down 10 English words from like the chocolate wrapper. Because in India, all these eatables are wrapped in, the wrappers are printed in English.
Okay.
So that was a good thing, you know, where kids could learn and pick up English words from all around them. Of course, here the focus is not just English, but literacy, you know, that, and also pushing the concept that you can learn from everything around you. Learning doesn't happen only in the classroom.
Yeah, I can imagine with that kind of situation where the view of school is that's where the learning happens and other things happen outside of the school hours, it would be a useful cultural change to try and get that kind of learning and growth mindset into the students, for wherever they go.
Exactly. One thing is, Fraser, that I've seen a big difference between middle-income community or high-income community parents and low-income community parents is this, right? When children come back from school, the educated parents engage with the children and, you know, basically supplement their learning by asking, what did you do in school? What did the teacher tell you? What did you learn? What did you find exciting? You know, what you didn't like in school today? And so on, right? And then middle-income, high-income community, educated parents start engaging with their children, teaching them about, like teaching them English words and other things, math, and basic life skills right from a right from the time the child is like 1 or 2 years old. Whereas the parents of my students in the low-income community schools, I've noticed that they tend to look at education as what the teacher provides in the school. And that's about it, right? The parents don't engage with children. I'm saying that it's not about English. I mean, parents even engaging with children in their own language after school and showing the children that you can learn from me also. For example, when they're cutting vegetables, when they're cooking, teaching children very basic life skills and home-based education was not happening much. So that kind of has a big impact on the on my students. And as a result, most of my students, I would say 30 plus out of the 42 I had, were at least two grade levels behind where they should have been. That is also because most of them do not go to KG school because they get free education only from grade one. And going to KG or nursery school means they have to pay for it. So most parents do not send the children to a play school or a nursery or a KG simply because they cannot afford it. That also means when kids start in grade one, they're quite behind. They're already lagging behind when it comes to basic skills they would have otherwise picked up, like fine motor skills and other things that we normally see develop in children who are 6 or 7 years old. So starting in a negative way, they're already lagging behind and when they come to grade one and grade two. And this lag only keeps on, you know, compounding as they go from one grade to another. And India, in the government schools, there is this concept that no child is failed or left behind in a grade because he or she is lagging behind.
So you just kind of progress as you age, and then whatever you get.
Yeah, age-appropriate grade. So even if a child is not ready to go to the next grade and is lagging behind academic in academic level, the child is simply taken to the next grade. And as a result, by the time many children reach grade 5 or 6, they are significantly behind, which impacts their self-confidence. And they don't see any point in going to school because the text, the English text or the local language text and math are simply beyond their understanding and reach. And they see no point in going to school because they don't understand anything at school. This is one big reason why a lot of children drop out, because being a couple of grade levels behind just frustrates them. Because classroom whatever the teacher teaches is beyond their understanding. And teachers simply do not have the resources or training to handle children and pull up children who are severely behind academically.
I'd like to thank our last sponsor of the night, and that's Squarespace. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, and online store. For free trial and 10% off, visit squarespace.com/out of school and enter the offer code PUPIL at checkout. A better web starts with your website. I want to sort of focus a little bit more on technology just now, and you referred to some of your children, like their fathers having a phone. What can you tell people, sort of, what does the landscape look like right now in terms of technology adoption in that kind of community? Because we hear stories all the time about how mobile phones are transforming, you know, African farmers' experience and so on. How does it work in that kind of situation in India?
Sure. So just like Africa, I think even in India, I would say mobile phones have completely transformed industries, have completely transformed people's lives in ways that we cannot even imagine now. What is interesting is millions of Indians are getting online for the first time using their mobile phones in the last 2-3 years than ever before. Mm-hmm. And that has changed the landscape in India, you know, and I would say it has given low-income community people two things: voice and choice.
Okay.
Earlier, it was not possible, you know, for low-income community people to have access to media, have access to these thousands of people to voice what they are experiencing and voice their concern, voice their protest. But now mobile phones have made this possible. Mm-hmm. And with the help of very cheap internet access in India. Now, most cities have 3G access and it's quite cheap. And many people have 2G internet access. And in low-income communities especially, the advent of very low-cost Android phones or other platform phones or even like pre-owned iPhones, you'll see them even in low-income communities. You know, people using very low-cost phones, smartphones, mm-hmm. with the help of very basic 2G or 3G packages are beginning to use it for everything. And it's also given them a lot of choices, you know, mm-hmm. because they go online, they share information on WhatsApp and other WeChat and other messaging platforms and so on. I was just thrilled to see a Facebook request from a couple of students I used to teach in Mumbai. They're not my own students, but students from another classroom where I used to kind of sometimes volunteer because the mm-hmm. teacher used to be absent. And those kids have created a Facebook account and started chatting with me or sending me messages, which is such a delight, you know. I never thought that day would come when I would see the students I taught mm-hmm. on Facebook and sending me messages.
Well, I think the thing you learn as you go through education is how quickly the students that were just young students are now very quickly become adults. I'm starting to get to that stage now where, you know, kids that I taught when I started teaching are now graduates of university and they're into their first and second jobs now. So I'm feeling that kind of age along with you.
Same here. I can't believe that these children I taught in 2010, now, boom, you know, they're mm-hmm. already on Facebook and sending me messages, and they're such curiosity, you know, to know about all this technology. And this wouldn't have been possible without smartphones. Like, you know, buying a laptop or a netbook or even a desktop mm-hmm. and then getting online is such a, you know, there are many pain points there. Mm-hmm. For example, electricity. I mean, to have a laptop and desktop, you need electricity access. And
quite a lot of electricity as well.
Exactly. Yeah. And also space, right? Mm-hmm. They live in 10 feet by 10 feet rooms, like 7 or 8 people share that room. Where is the space for laptop and desktop? And also the initial investment is quite high, mm-hmm. whereas a mobile phone can be easily shared among people. It has everything inbuilt into it, you know, camera and everything. So I've seen that it being adopted very well in the community.
That's very interesting.
Technology in the schools I would say that hasn't taken such, I mean, that hasn't seen much adoption in low-income community schools in the communities that I was teaching in. Because the schools mostly do not have projectors. They do have a TV, but it's an old generation cathode ray tube TV. So when you walk around the classrooms and when you walk around the school corridors, you would see very little technology being used by the teachers, because they still prefer the very traditional chalk piece and blackboard kind of teaching. There are some outlier teachers, you know, who take initiatives to use the smartphones connected to the TV using the, you know, VGA port. And there are some who take such initiatives. For example, when children ask questions, they immediately go to YouTube and show that video to children. But I would say mostly they don't use technology much in their classrooms.
It's interesting because even, you know, students in the low-income communities will be having this a similar experience to many students in developed countries, where they're used to, you know, going on a smartphone, going onto YouTube,
yes,
going onto Wikipedia, and,
yes,
and learning for themselves already. And that culture will be building and building. And in school, you know, that disparity between outside school and inside school is coming to you, as well as, you know, it's been here for us for a few years now. But it's interesting to see that step exists everywhere, you know, in school scenario and the informal learning, the self-directed learning that can happen through these technologies outside the school.
Yeah, I noticed that many of my students used to borrow their dad's phone initially only to play games, or take pictures with the camera. But once, you know, the kids got very comfortable with using the phone, they started using other features like Googling and searching for pictures and or watching small, you know, short, like Bollywood movie clips that the father had on the phone and so on. So I could notice that even kids who were only 6 or 7 years old in my school were quite comfortable using smartphones. In accessing knowledge online or accessing video clips on YouTube and other things. So I would say that the kids are very smart, but only thing that stopped them from this is just access and exposure, which I wanted to eliminate by bringing technology into my classroom. For example, the iPad, the Wii Sports console, and water, like projectors, like microwave oven. I used to bring that to show kids,
okay,
oh yeah, this is something that you can cook in, you know. So we made popcorn in the classroom using a microwave oven, and that was something amazing for them to see, that you can make popcorn using this oven. I got this thing called Fryams, which you usually deep fry and eat, like chips. But I bought the Fryams that are shaped like alphabets. So I used to give the Fryams to the children and say, if you make words, I will bake it for you in the microwave.
There's motivation right there.
Oh, really? And they used to make really long words because I was struggling to get them learn long words and, you know, synonyms and antonyms. And this really helped because they would start making long words, synonyms, and so on, which I would bake it in the oven and give it to them to eat. And it was a big hit in the classroom.
I may adopt that technique for my classroom as well.
Yeah, you should do that. It's going to be so much fun.
But I think it's very interesting that, you know, to be trying to develop a growth mindset in your students at a time when, even if it can't happen in the school necessarily, their access to that information outside the school. And in many ways, you're doing the thing that is potentially most valuable to them right now, is to make them believe that they can learn for themselves at times outside the school. And then the access to technology will bring up so much of those resources that they're looking for.
Exactly. See, in Mumbai, on an average, I got only 3 hours teaching time. Because my class was from 1 to 5:30. with a half an hour lunch break and a 15-minute washroom break and so on. So on an average, I got only 3 hours. And if it's raining heavily, we had to send the kids home early and so on. So many issues. I used to constantly drive this point to the children that you don't just learn from me. You know, 10 years ago, who you got the knowledge from and where you got it from mattered a lot. Typically, it was a teacher who gave a lot of knowledge to the students. Mm-hmm. But now, you know, technology has changed things so much that it doesn't really matter where you get the knowledge from. But all that matters is what do you do with the knowledge? How do you connect the dots? And access to information has become so easy. Mm-hmm. Right? It's just a matter of having access to a smartphone and internet. And you can Google and find out. You can go to YouTube and find out. I mean, youngsters these days no longer use Google. They just go to YouTube.
YouTube's a destination now, isn't it?
Yeah, YouTube has become search. Or they That's go and do image search. They no longer do text-based search because they are impatient, right? Yeah. They are impatient and hungry to learn and know more. So I used to show that to my students that 5 years from now or 10 years from now, it would no longer matter. You may not even start searching for information. It will be like all around you. What truly matters is what do you do with it, right? And I didn't want my students to be left behind compared to, say, a middle-income community children or high-income community students. Mm-hmm. I wanted them to have that exposure and access right from now so that they are prepared for what was coming in the upcoming years for them in school and life.
Yeah, it has the opportunity to be a great leveler as well.
Exactly.
Everybody's on the same internet, right?
Yeah. Level playing field, as they call it.
It's been fascinating to me, though, and I've talked about this on many shows, like just the impact that YouTube is having on children's informal and formal education that, you know, about a year ago, you know, I used to use YouTube as a kind of, you know, I would search on Google and if a video came up, I would go and watch it on YouTube, right? But I think I imagine you're seeing the same thing, that students today are using YouTube in a completely different way from people of our age are using YouTube. You know, they're actively subscribed to channels and they're focused on, you know, particular individuals who are authoring on YouTube and things like that, and they're focused on streams of content. They look at YouTube like you know, educational TV channel.
Exactly, yeah. And especially in India now, Google India has launched YouTube Offline, so people can actually download YouTube on their YouTube videos for offline viewing.
Really.
And many mobile carriers are offering lower rates for YouTube viewing, because that used to consume a lot of data and people were not using YouTube as much as Google wanted them to. So, you know, they're coming up with India-specific packages, which is great for low-income community students because they can just take their father's phone and, you know, go to YouTube and check, which already many of my students were beginning to do. Mm-hmm. So lack of internet access at home in the form of broadband or Wi-Fi hasn't really deterred students from getting on the internet using the smartphone, which I find very interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting and encouraging, you know. That
very encouraging, yeah.
People are really valuing that. I mean, I've looked at statistics even from the UK where the number one reason why people are not on the internet in the UK is not because there's a section of the population who can't afford it. The number one reported reason is because I'm just not interested. And that tends to be in people, you know, at the very upper end of the age range, you know. But I think our numbers here are something like 92% of all households with children in them are on the internet. And the rest of them just say they're not interested. Now, whether that's true or they're just using that reason, they don't want to admit that they maybe can't afford it, I'm not sure. But access to the internet is something that almost every family seems to value now. It's becoming such a kind of fundamental part of everybody's experience.
That's interesting, because it's really interesting that you say that, because when I draw a parallel to India, most people basically pay for internet access to learn more about something either to do with Bollywood or religion. or cricket.
Okay, cricket, yeah,
right?
Of course.
So yeah. These are three big motivators for people to go online, at least I would say in low-income communities. Either Bollywood, it's cricket, or something to do with religion, right? Mm-hmm. But the interesting thing is, these are three very strong pulls for them to get on online. But once they get online, then they figure out that they can do a lot more than just Bollywood, religion, and cricket.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Mm-hmm. And I'm glad that they're at least getting online to satisfy their curiosity about Bollywood, religion, and cricket. Because once they're online, they learn from some other friends that, oh, you can do this. Oh, you can book train tickets. You can book flight tickets and you can order things online and so on. So, mm-hmm. And once they get online, their students also get that opportunity. So I'm glad that these three things are pulling them in online and they find it fascinating.
Yeah, there's always a hook somewhere, isn't there?
Yeah, and in this case, there are at least three major hooks.
So let's take your story on a little bit more, Srini. After Teach for India, you were awarded a fellowship to come to London and do some studying, is that right?
That's right, yeah. It's called a Shivning Gurukul program at the London School of Economics. It's a three-month program where they select 12 Indians every year to do the program at London School of Economics. And from this year onwards, it's offered at the King's College.
Okay.
So mine was the last batch at the LSE.
Okay.
And it's mostly for mid-career, professionals, for them to come together to UK and learn about UK leadership stories and India and UK partnership and so on. And then you go back and work on your area of interest.
Okay.
So my 3 months here at the London School of Economics and staying in London and learning about both India and UK success stories was very, very, valuable for me. Because after my engineering, I never went back to school or, I mean, college or university, you know. So taking these 3 months off, coming here to London, spending time with, the faculty and students at London School of Economics was very valuable for me, both personally and professionally.
How did it come about that you got that fellowship?
So one of my college mates who works for the World Bank now in Washington, D.C., had done this program a few years back. And he highly recommended that I do this. He pushed me for the last 3-4 years to apply for this. And last year, after leaving Teach for India, I had some time at hand. So I thought, okay, I will definitely do this program.
Great. And how do you, can you assess the sort of impact that had? Well, firstly, what did you do? And then how did that impact? Did you just take lectures or did you have, was it more broad-based than that?
Sure, yeah. It was a combination of... our program was under the Department of Management at LSE.
Okay.
And the course itself is called, Global Leadership Program. So it was a combination of classroom, like lectures, and then invited lectures by various faculty and professors. And we could do elective courses also, plus a project that we had to complete. A project on any UK success stories that we could present. So it and study oriented visits to the Scottish Parliament, to the NATO office, and so on. So it was very, very diverse. Had many elements of leadership put together. My project was based on education. And I chose three different case studies to present. One of them was ESA Academy, the other was Teach for All, and another was a nonprofit organization working on education. So because I wanted to do a project that would also help me, when I go back to India. So I learned a lot, not just from the three case studies I took up, but also a lot from the people I interacted with in the course of the project and from my Shivning Gurukul batchmates as well.
Okay.
Because most of them are mid or late mid-career executives, mm-hmm. some in the government, some in private sector, and so on, so, and some in social entrepreneurship as well. So learning from them was, I would say, the big highlight of my program.
Okay. Can you identify any sort of major lessons that you took away that have impacted what you do now?
One thing that I learned a lot from my peers, but some of the things that I still value and cherish a lot are one is how taking a break for your own professional development.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not really time wasted, but it's actually a big investment in yourself, right?
Mm-hmm.
Even more so when it comes to social development work. Because for the last four and a half years, I've been like constantly working so much that I never thought about investing in myself professionally.
Mm-hmm.
And, I'm glad that I did this. And this, I owe it to my batchmates and my friends who really pushed me to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Second thing is about the power of networking and in investing in people for a common cause.
Mm-hmm.
So my Shivning Gurukul batchmates helped me in understanding how do you invest leaders from different fields in causes that you are working on. And they helped me in understanding, how do you invest in people who are leaders in completely different fields, in the causes that you believe in India.
Mm-hmm.
So many such leadership lessons I've learned. For example, one person is one batchmate was a deputy legal head in one prominent bank. And from him, I learned the power of questioning. You know, he has a law background. So he taught me about the power of questioning and negotiations as well. Because mm-hmm. these skills are so important when it comes to social development work. So I learned a lot about negotiations and questioning from him as well. Another batchmate worked in the broadcasting industry for 15 years. She used to be a TV anchor and journalist.
Okay.
I learned a lot from her about, how do you work with common people on the streets who you have no idea about? And how do you go talk to them? How do you, invest them? How do you bring them on board?
Mm-hmm.
And that is a very important skill when you're talking about, working in low-income communities.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, many such lessons. I can go on and on, but I'll stop here.
I'm sure. I mean, it's something that I have always regretted my life. I went to Glasgow University and I did various things there. And one of my biggest regrets is that I'm not really in touch with anybody from those days. And I was born and brought up in Greenock and, child of a single parent and everything. And I'm in no way comparing my life story to yours or anybody else's that you've taught. But I went to university intensely unprepared for that aspect of the opportunity that was afforded me at university, which was to get to know the kinds of people who would go on to, work in the World Bank, be part of various other, large scale organizations and be in a position to, build a social network, offline social network that would one day be, potentially useful to me. And I think it's something that I'm increasingly concerned to kind of impart to my students is that people, there's a great opportunity there every time you move into a new situation where there are new groups of people. There's a great opportunity to broaden your base of social operations, if you like, to benefit not just to benefit yourself, but to benefit the cause that you or the thing you want to achieve, or to help other people as well. And it's something that I feel like people from Scotland are very kind of reticent about sometimes. And you know, a lot of people use this phrase, you know, it's not what you know, it's who you know. So to which I always kind of question.
It's true in India also,
I always question to myself, you know, why don't we teach children to know other people? You know, we don't really, that's not, like, social network or networking, business networking is not a subject on the curriculum at all. Why don't we put it there? Because you know that the people who are good at it get so much value out of being good at it. And the rest of us who never were brought up in families that were good at it just don't get that opportunity. And I think we should have a new course in that.
Definitely. And that's one big thing that I learned in my program. And that was the focus of the program also, you know, networking for investing people, networking for also networking without any expectations, you know, like getting to know people, taking a genuine interest in the work that others do. And because that really enriches your life also, you know, knowing people who are doing great work, great and passionate work in whatever field they are in. And without any idea of, okay, this will be helpful for me someday. No, you know, you're just knowing these people because they love what they are doing. And it's great to know such passionate people.
Absolutely. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. So, Srini, it's been great talking to you. Let's wrap up by telling me about your current projects. What's going on right now for you?
Half my time I spend in three different classrooms in Chennai. You know, earlier I had just one iPad that I got by raising funds, running marathons. But now, thanks to you, thanks to Abdul Chauhan from his academy and some other kind souls who have donated some iPads, you know, to my three classrooms. So now I teach 1:2, I would say. Yeah. One iPad for every two students and using a set of apps made by Lipa Learning in Prague and some other apps like Osmo Kit. I teach children basic numeracy and literacy skills using these apps in a very structured way. But the first few classes have been about iPad and introducing them to the fact that they were all saying, oh, it's a big phone. So I had to tell them that this is a computer. You know, let's start there. This is a computer. Because their concept of computer is like a big box with keyboard and mouse and so on. So I had to teach them that, no, this is also a computer. These three classrooms are in a school that's right next to the biggest graveyard in Chennai. And it's traditionally been a very, very low-income community right next to the railway track as well. So it's like in between a graveyard and a railway track. And the children are super happy to engage with the iPad and learn from it. And I'm taking it very step-by-step approach because it's been quite challenging for me to manage the iPads as well, you know, like charge them, update the apps, and take it to the students. And I'm learning how to manage multiple devices in multiple classrooms. So I used to think that, oh, if I had 20 iPads or 15 iPads, it'll be so easy. But I'm realizing that it's not, it's far, far more challenging than I ever imagined it to be. Because the thing is, simple thing is, children don't own the iPad. They don't take it home. Right? And I don't assign one iPad to two children in the sense that every time I go to the school, that iPad goes to a different set of kids, right? Which means we have to log out, log in. If I want to maintain their learning records, I need to have profiles of them on. So I'm learning all these things now, but the benefits far outweigh the challenges and the pain points of you know, having multiple iPads in the classroom. And for that, I think it's been really, really worth it. Seeing the kids engage and learn from the apps. And these are children who are otherwise quite naughty and, you know, mischievous, and they run around, run outside the classroom, and they are very restless and don't engage easily with the lessons. But here with the iPads, they are engaging a lot, even though they are iPad 1s and iPad minis. But I saw the engagement levels and learning levels, you know, really go up.
Yeah, it's good to know that that experience is replicated. We've certainly seen that as well. It's something we sort of forget to talk about sometimes because it's been so long since we started with iPad, but
yeah,
you know, definitely seen, you know, that sort of petty indiscipline stuff is much, much lower in our school than it ever was before. And the engagement levels, you know, people report that all the time about iPad programs, is engagement levels, particularly among boys, just goes up and up and up.
Yeah, definitely. And listening to your podcast and talking to you about these things and reading your tweets and posts have really helped me here also, Fraser. And I still struggle with a lot of other things, you know, just managing all those mm-hmm. iPads and the software and everything. But I'm slowly learning here as well. So this is my volunteer teaching part. And the remaining part, I'm doing multiple things at the same time. One is I'm involved in a CSR project involving solar technology in villages, like basically villages that don't have electricity or any lighting facility.
Okay.
Putting solar panels there and bringing lighting with a focus on livelihoods. Mm-hmm. And then night schools for children who take care of cattle in the daytime.
Okay.
And also I'm supporting Teach for India and Akanksha Foundation in a project. So in between, I also do teacher training in technology for low-income community schools. So multiple projects at the same time, but half my time I do keep for you know, teaching in the classrooms, and I want to continue to do that.
I love that you just named three things, one of which was a night school, and then you talked about what you do in between times.
If I find time, I run marathons. I just finished my 18th full marathon recently for a fundraising campaign that, you know, basically I got Christmas wish lists from 20 low-income community classrooms, and mm-hmm. I raised funds to fulfill their wish list. So I'm super happy.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, I'm super happy that their wish list got fulfilled.
Well, I can only say that I hope nobody from my school listens to this, because I hope we're not going to adopt marathon running as a fundraising mechanism, because I think I'd probably make it to the first water station and then probably just die. So I'm afraid I'm not built for such things.
No, I was like that also. I started running 4 years ago, but I think I'm quite blessed and lucky that nothing has happened so far. I've been able to run Forrest Gump. Run, Forrest, run.
There you go. Fantastic. Yeah. So Srini, thank you so much for taking the time to just, you know, talk to us and tell us your life story and the story of the life that your students lead and the impact that you're trying to have on them. And I think it's, you know, all credit to you for everything you've done. I think it's been in whatever small way we've been able to help you, I'm glad to have had that opportunity. And if you ever need any help, is there a way that other listeners who might want to help can do so?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I always believe in, you know, impact. I believe in the power of basically, what do you call it? You know, like, for example, in crowdfunding, the power of many mm-hmm. people coming together, doing small acts of kindness to make a big change in the community. So people can definitely, you know, contribute. And not necessarily money, right? It could be very simple resources. And it mm-hmm. could also be things like just doing a Skype chat with my students in the classroom or so. Mm-hmm. So there are many ways that people can contribute and help. Okay. And it need not be necessarily money, in so many other ways. So, yeah, anyone can get in touch with me. If they just find my about.me page, they can get in touch with me, and I can help them figure out how they can contribute.
Okay, I'll definitely put all those links to that page and your Twitter and everything into the show notes for this episode as well.
Sure.
So if folk are listening, and they can get into it that way as well. So sure. Hopefully we'll be able to connect you with some other people who can add to what you're doing. I think it's been an excellent chat, Srini. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Fraser. Have a good evening.